Welcome to Simple Living Works, episode 69. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host with my guest, renowned biblical scholar and author, Walter Brueggemann. After the conversation in this episode, I will report on the death of Alternative's founder and on another new service we're offering, and also share some of the responses we've received recently. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye at my cue. Professor Brueggemann and I worked together on a project when I headed Alternatives for Simple Living, 1995 to 2007. He wrote the biblical reflections for the first edition of our best-known Advent Christmas resource, Whose Birthday Is It Anyway?, in 1988, and served as a judge and wrote the foreword for our collection of new hymns, Sing Justice, Do Justice, in 1998. Links to both those items are in the show notes. I recently read his 90-page book, Sabbath as Resistance, Saying No to the Culture of Now. Walter Brueggemann, born March 1933 in Tilden, Nebraska, is an American Protestant Old Testament scholar and theologian. Brueggemann is widely considered one of the most influential Old Testament scholars of the last several decades. He received degrees from Elmhurst College and Eden Theological Seminary in 1958, a Doctor of Theology from Union Theological Seminary in New York in 1961, a Ph.D. from St. Louis University in 1974. The son of a minister of the German Evangelical Synod of North America, he was ordained in the United Church of Christ. He was professor of Old Testament from 1961 to 86 and dean from 68 to 82 at Eden Theological Seminary, and then beginning in 1986, he served as the William Marcellus McPheeters Professor of Old Testament at Columbia Theological Seminary, from which he retired in the early 2000s. He currently resides in Cincinnati, Ohio. Brueggemann is an advocate and practitioner of rhetorical criticism. He has written more than 58 books, hundreds of articles, and several commentaries on books of the Bible. He is also a contributor to a number of the Living the Questions DVD programs and is featured in the program Countering Pharaoh's Production Consumption Society Today. He participated in Bill Moyer's PBS television series on Genesis. See links in the show notes to his books, audiovisual resources, and detailed biography. Originally a strong supporter of Israel and its biblical claims, Brueggemann later repudiated Israel for its exploitation of ancient promises to create a toxic ideology, and now affirms his belief that it is not anti-Semitic to stand up for justice for Palestinians. A lot of people think of Sabbath in terms of a day off, or they think in terms of Sabbath rest, you know, a day to be quiet. But there's just so much more to Sabbath, and I really appreciate your recent book, Sabbath as Resistance. It has surely opened my eyes to the importance of Sabbath and so many of the other issues that we deal with, not only in the Old Testament, but also in the New Testament. That is, things like justice, things like gleaning, things like jubilee. They're all there. And so I'd like to start off just by talking about, in a contemporary context, about Sabbath. We think of some stores here in the Midwest as being really kind to their employees by being closed on Sundays. We have, Hobby Lobby is closed on Sundays. We have Chick-fil-A that's closed on Sundays. We even have a grocery store chain called Fairway that's closed on Sundays, and we applaud them for that. But on the other hand, it seems like some of these companies are not all that kind to their employees. And so we're wondering if maybe there's something's confused here about what Sabbath really means.
Right. Well, I think that since the Puritans at the founding of white America, there's been a kind of a legalistic strain to the Sabbath, so that closing on Sunday or not working on Sunday has been a kind of a rule. And I think in order to understand the Sabbath, we have to go behind that legalistic understanding to see that it was originally in ancient Israel, and then in the church practice, it was a way of articulating the conviction that our life does not consist in working and earning and producing and consuming and spending. And I think that Sabbath as a regular observance is a declaration that our life is not defined by that. And I think some of those companies, I'm glad that those companies close on Sunday, but I suspect they do not very well understand that this is a ethical, theological assertion that we're not going to have our lives defined by the pursuit of dollars and the things that dollars can generate for us. So I think that legalistic understanding of it probably has been a distortion of its true intention from its biblical roots.
Well, let's start right at the beginning, because even though the Sabbath comes up in the fourth commandment, it's a pivotal commandment between the first ones that relate with God and then the other six that relate to our neighbors. And so how does the Sabbath relate to the first commandment? Idolatry.
Well, Ten Commandments in the version in Exodus 20, which is the one we know best, it says that you shall keep the Sabbath, for on the seventh day of creation, God the Creator rested. And that, of course, is a reference back to the creation narrative in Genesis 1 and 2, so that it is a remembrance that even God, for all of the work of creating the world, culminated that whole process by rest, and that when we keep Sabbath rest, we are imitating God and we are resting the way God rested and the way God built rest into the rhythm and structure of creation. Taken that way, I think, as imitation of God, it is a recovery or a recognition of our creatureliness, that we are creatures who have life as a gift from God and who are to give our life back to God in honor and in obedience. So that version of the Ten Commandments really is geared to what it means to be in sync with creation. In the second presentation of the Ten Commandments in Deuteronomy 5, which is a text that we do not know as well, it's very interesting that the seventh day of creation is not mentioned, because in that version it says you shall keep the Sabbath day and you shall remember that you were slaves in Egypt. So that it really is a remembrance of emancipation from coercive labor, and that commandment more likely looks forward to the following six commandments on relating to the neighbor. So if you take those two versions of the Ten Commandments, the one in Exodus looks back to God the Creator who rests, and the one in Deuteronomy looks forward to the neighbors who are also entitled to rest. And I think to keep both of those reference points in purview is probably very important.
Now, when this commandment was first given through Moses, Of course, the people were remembering their exodus from Egypt and the frenetic lives they had in Egypt. And so this was weird that they got a day off.
It was weird because in Pharaoh's Egypt, I suspect there was no Sabbath rest for anyone. There certainly wasn't any for the slaves who were making bricks, but I suspect there was not for Pharaoh's management team either, because they had to keep the production schedules up and they had to worry about keeping the production machinery working. And I suspect that economy, like our own busy economy, was a rat race for all parties. So that when the Sabbath is referred back to the Exodus, then it is a declaration that the economy does not need to be organized in such a, I like your word, in such a frenetic way that reduces all of life to a rat race under the conviction that we've not done enough yet, we've not produced enough yet, we've not been enough yet, we've not owned enough yet, and of course we never will. So that that kind of rat race is under the illusion that if you work harder and run faster, somehow you'll be successful, and of course you never will. So I think that the commandment referred to Pharaoh and the Exodus is very wise in recognizing that the life that is reflected in endless work is a life that is in the end dehumanizing for all parties.
Now, it's interesting that, you know, after they left Egypt, you think they would have been relieved, but instead they started this new culture of their own of acquisitiveness. And a lot of it was based on gold, symbolized in, of course, the golden calf. So I guess Moses had his hands full trying to get them to stop replicating what they had come from.
I think that's right. And I think the 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet, probably is very reflective of that acquisitive society in which it was regarded as a normal, if not a virtue, to be wanting stuff that other people have and to be devising ways to take it away from them, which is, of course, is pretty much what Pharaoh did. Pharaoh confiscated people's food and people's land and people's bodies because he thought he didn't have enough yet. And I think that the Exodus is really a refusal to participate in the economy that Pharaoh had sponsored.
But they didn't refuse. They tried to rebuild that economy in their own way.
Well, that's right. I think that covetous system of social relationships, on the one hand, is grounded in a sense of scarcity, that we don't have enough yet, and is propelled by anxiety. I think that against that horizon of scarcity, that Sabbath is an invitation to recognize the abundance of God's creation, that there is enough food generated for all creatures, and therefore we do not need to live our lives out of anxiety. So it really is an offer of a wholly different way to live, and taking Sabbath rest is done in that horizon, is done in the conviction that there is more than enough, and if I stop and rest, I am not going to miss out on getting more. I am not going to fall behind. But in fact, I am going to be able to live out my God-given identity as a Sabbath creature.
Now, much of the rest was intended for worship. And of course, they eventually built a temple in Jerusalem. Solomon built this lavish, lavish temple. And so it's more than symbolism, though. There is an actual resistance going on here by resting on the Sabbath. That is taking ourselves out of the system.
That's right. It is to say we are simply not going to play that game. We are not going to participate in that rat race, and we are not going to have our lives defined by it. And I think that Solomon's temple, which, as you've indicated, really specialized in gold, I think it is a total distortion of Sabbath faith. I don't think Solomon understood anything about that, and his whole kingdom, including his Sabbath, is really built on acquisitiveness, which is a violation of Sabbath, so that, in fact, what Solomon does is to replicate inside Israel what Pharaoh did outside of Israel. And it cannot be unimportant that Solomon is Pharaoh's son-in-law. He married the boss's daughter, and in fact, he continues the kind of predatory economic practices that were central to Pharaoh's regime. So he had no understanding of Sabbath rest, I think. And the extent to which he practiced it at all is kind of a throwback of an ancient practice to which he was not, in fact, committed at all.
That's kind of the negative view of Sabbath, but there's also a very positive view of Sabbath, and that's, as you call it, neighborliness. And it's in spending our time not just, you know, talking on the front porch, but pursuing justice and not just looking at symbolic things like how fancy our churches are or how elaborate our worship services are, but that we actually are pursuing justice and neighborliness.
That's right. And the full expression of that, as you know, is in what one scholar has called the Sabbatic principle, so that if you take the rule of 7 days, what they did was to expand it to the rule of 7 years. And in the book of Deuteronomy, there is a legal provision that at the end of 7 years, debts on poor people have to be canceled. And that is an extension of Sabbath that made it possible for poor people to rest because they were not in a rat race trying to pay their debt or trying to pay the interest on their debt. And then that same Sabbatic principle is written even larger in the Jubilee year, which is every 49 years, or which is 7 times 7 years, at which time the land shall be given rest, and there'll be a general rest from all of the busy activity of making our life more powerful and more connected and more influential and all of that. So that Sabbath is an occasion to recognize that poor people in debt, in fact, our neighbors. So they're not an economic drag or an economic inconvenience, but they are neighbors to be honored and respected and given the wherewithal that they can live a viable life in the world. So it's a mistake to think that Sabbath is simply an act of rest that is turned inward on oneself. In fact, it is the great day of noticing the neighbors and attending to the neighbors in restorative kinds of ways.
Well, we see movements going on in recent years. There was a Jubilee year not too many years ago, with a great push to forgive debts from the developing world. We hear about a Jubilee a movement to forgive student debts. And these are all well and good. It just seems to me, though, we don't need to wait every seventh year or every Jubilee year, that this is giving us a model of how we deal with people on a regular basis, day to day.
I think that's exactly right. So that the Sabbath becomes an organizing principle for all social relationships, and it really represents a massive critique of our economy that has reduced everything down to a commodity. So it's not unimportant that the icon in front of Wall Street is a gold calf. It's a replication of the golden calf in which we bow down and worship our precious metals and our commodities. And Sabbath is simply an insistence that the economy does not need to be organized that way. It can be organized so that all the neighbors are able to participate in a viable way. Nobody is left behind. Nobody is left as a permanent underclass. Nobody is left as hopelessly indebted because the community wants to organize social relationships and economic practices so that that does not happen. So it is not simply an occasional day of rest, as you are indicating, but it really is a conviction about organizing social practices differently.
I really am intrigued by your concept of resistance to multitasking. You know, this whole idea that you know, we can go to church, but we're always looking at our watches or making lists of things we need to do later in the day.
Or we're looking at our cell phones in church.
that is broader, though, than just those particular examples. And
that's correct. That's right. I think I find it helpful to think that Sabbath practice is being on the receiving end of gifts that God wants to give us. Our normal economic assumption is that our work is to be on the getting end, on the producing end, on the possessing end, on the owning end, which is greatly intentional activity. But to be on the receiving end means to wait. It means to be quiet. It means to be in anticipation of gifts that we have not earned and that we cannot have on demand, but we are waiting for the enactment of God's generosity and God's graciousness. So those gifts are given on God's terms, and Sabbath is an exercise of putting our life on God's terms.
I want to run a term by you that I have heard and I have used, in fact, myself, and I like your input. It's called the rolling Sabbath. Now, not everybody can get Sundays off. And, you know, people have a lot of obligations with family and what have you. But a rolling Sabbath, as I understand it, is a commitment to take a Sabbath rest, but not in one 24-hour period. It's that we apportion our Sabbath throughout the week. Now, how do you feel about that? Do you think that's a realistic solution, or do you think that's just phony?
Well, I think one does have to be realistic and pragmatic, But it is also the case, I think, that a serious Sabbath is likely to be inconvenient. So it's not a matter of keeping Sabbath when we don't have anything else to do. It's a matter of having a regular, routinized discipline that says, when this time comes, I'm stopping it no matter what I'm doing. So I think that the idea, that's a new word to me. I hadn't heard of a rolling Sabbath, and I think that's all right as long as it does not mean that I'm going to keep doing everything in my life, and if there comes a pause when it's inconvenient and not demanding for me, then I will do a little Sabbath rest. I think that's a misunderstanding, that I think it requires discipline and intentionality that, in fact, interrupts the routines of our life of production and consumption.
Now, Sabbath rest, as you indicated early on, is not just for humans. Sabbath rest is also a concept for animals and for the earth.
That's correct. And I think it's very important that the creation side of Sabbath clearly meant that everybody should rest. And as you know, the commandment says your donkey and your ox and your son and your daughter and the immigrant and your slave, if they had slavery, everybody has to rest. And I've been wondering, even in a technological society, whether it doesn't mean that our machines need to rest. Maybe our technical apparatus also needs to be turned off so that there can be quiet in the earth. I'm not thinking that we ought to be legalistic about any of that, but I do think that we need to think intentionally and with discipline that is often inconvenient.
It seems to me that this has some bearing on, you know, the climate crisis, or as I prefer to call it, the creation crisis, that, you know, we hear people say things like, let's leave it in the ground. We need to leave those fossil fuels in the ground. And it makes sense to me that this is a Sabbath concept.
I think that's exactly right. I agree with that. It's a whole different understanding of the earth rather than thinking that it is our possession to use any way we want to do. There is a kind of an awe and respect for the earth as a creature alongside us that is not there simply for our use and enjoyment and convenience. This also calls, I think, for an act of resistance.
You mentioned earlier about the immigrant, and the Sabbath also is a commentary on exclusiveness. That is, you know, who's in and who's out.
That's right.
And this has some, should have some theological bearing, some moral bearing on how we view immigrants.
That's correct, and particularly in the Sabbath commandment in Deuteronomy, it says that, and it names all these people: your son, your daughter, your immigrant, your ox, your donkey. On the Sabbath day, they shall be like you. So that Sabbath is the great day of social equalization. All the days when the market operates, we make all these distinctions about insiders and outsiders and has and have-nots, but the commandment intends that on Sabbath all of those distinctions are overcome, and we are all in a common awareness that we are creatures of God who live by God's gifts. And when we think that way, then those of us who are habituated here, we have no high moral ground over immigrants because immigrants are as us. They are also creatures of God who, as we do, who live by God's gifts. And Sabbath is a bodily acknowledgement of that.
Now, some people might argue that, you know, the Jubilee is just mentioned in a few obscure passages in the Old Testament. But there are some of us who believe that the Gospels are conveying Jubilee, that the Gospels, the Jubilee is a gospel concept. It has something to do with the kingdom of God, for example.
I think that's right. I think that's particularly true in the Gospel of Luke, Luke 4, where Jesus famously came back to the synagogue at Nazareth, and he read the scroll from Isaiah 61, where it says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." That phrase, "the year of the Lord's favor," is commonly thought to be the Jubilee year, and many interpreters of the Gospel of Luke believe that what Jesus was doing in his ministry, as it's presented in the Gospel of Luke, was indeed enacting a Jubilee year. And of course, because he was enacting a Jubilee year, that is the reason that he promptly evoked great hostility from the managers of the predatory economy, because the managers of the predatory economy do not want debts forgiven. They don't want people to have a day off. They don't want rest to be definitional for social relationships, so that his proclamation and enactment of the Jubilee year represented a very significant threat to the predatory economy that was dominant. And then you can see in the Gospel of Luke, more than in any other gospel, he tells a number of parables that really have to do with an inversion of the economy. So you get in chapter 12, you get the parable of the rich fool who always wanted more. In chapter 14, you get the parable of the banquet that was served for street people. In chapter 16, you get the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, or it's a Dives, the poor man, and all of these parables. If you take them all together, they are imagining social relationships that are operative outside of the predatory economy, and I would say all of that is a Sabbath insight.
Well, this is a delight speaking to you. I would be remiss if I didn't ask, what maybe you have some future plans. You've written so many books and so many articles, inspired so many people. But do you have something coming up in the near future you'd like to let us know about?
Well, I have a book that's in press that will be published in the fall by Westminster John Knox Press, and it is a study exactly of money in the Bible and how the Bible teaches us to think about our possessions. So it really is quite related to Sabbath issues, and I think that will be my best shot on this subject.
I'll indeed look forward to reading that. I almost feel silly asking this question, but is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think you are on target, and I must say that your ministry on simple living, it seems to me, is so important and so urgent in this predatory economy of anxiety in which we live, and I think to de-escalate that into simple living is a terribly important enterprise for us. so that I'm very grateful for the ministry that you do.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to my conversation with renowned biblical scholar and author Walter Brueggemann. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com or on our Facebook page or on the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org. Click window number 3. I'm sad to report on the death of Alternative's founder. I recently received this message. I wanted to reach out to those of you who have been carrying on my dad's work. Bob Kaczynski passed away early on May 5th after a long struggle with Alzheimer's disease. One of the things that gave him comfort in the twilight of his years was knowing that folks like you were continuing his work. My sister Michelle and I wanted to reach out and let you know the news and to thank you for your ongoing efforts. Godspeed, Chris Kaczynski. See the link in the show notes to Alternative's history with photos from 1973 to the present, and also a historical note from Bob on Alternative's 20th anniversary. Although I didn't meet Bob face-to-face, we corresponded. I remember one especially touching note from him that said simply, "Don't let my organization die." During those years, he became active in a social justice organization called Mississippi 2020. Unfortunately, Mississippi was one of the handful of states from which I didn't receive an invitation for my speaking tours. Within Alternative's inner circle, Bob was known as a visionary rather than a maintainer. He was good at getting important things started, and then he was willing to pass them on to others. Rest in peace, Bob. On a happier note, if you search the internet for Simple Living Radio, Simple Living Works takes a top slot on Stitcher, the most popular app for podcasts on mobile devices. Heard recently from my friend Warren. He said, "Simple living is hard work and requires a lot of attention to detail. It ain't easy." And from Lilia, I heard, "It does work." Mary Williams wrote, "This is so wonderful to see. Many years back, I subscribed to Alternatives for Simple Living, and then they could not continue. So happy that it has been resurrected. Their ideas then changed how I lived." Thank you, Mary. Simple living works. Yes, voluntary simplicity is not only effective, satisfying, faithful, and comprehensive, it also gets to work. It requires effort, psychologically and spiritual, to break wasteful habits and to find earth-friendly ones, and then practically to implement and maintain those positive habits. I've started a new service to encourage our efforts called Our Simple Living Daily Nudge. While my weekly digest or blog is quite extensive, some might call it text-heavy, it contains some 50 links. The Daily Nudge is designed to have just one quote, one idea, one link. By the way, each entry is indexed, so if you miss a day, you can catch up. Subscriptions are free on Twitter and by email. Weekly editions are planned for LinkedIn and Facebook, later maybe Pinterest and Instagram. So if you're all not already following Simple Living Works on those social media, sign up right away. A full description of this new service is given on the Simple Living Works website. Visit simplelivingworks.org, click on Nudge in window number 2. Links are also given in the show notes. One of my early subscribers to the Nudge reported, "While I read so far, I enjoyed much more than some of your podcasts. There are some really good nudges and admonitions that help us keep on track. I did the junk mail thing, but never got them to stop. So I use the junk mail to put in raised beds at the bottom, and I don't have to fill up with so much dirt to get started growing. I put some cardboard in, too. Of course, whatever you grow doesn't take packaging, and that is a good thing. Thanks. Also subscribe if this is a good example." That's going to take some work to come up with new nudges every day. Thank you, Anna Lorraine. Well, time to wrap up this episode of Simple Living Works podcast. If you're new to Simple Living Works podcast and would like more basic information about the organization, please listen a little longer. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye here. Peace. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember, you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works podcast. They're archived twice. Access them at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want with or without show notes. Subscription to this podcast on our weekly blog and our new Daily Nudge are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. You can also subscribe in iTunes to other podcasts that I produce called The Common Good Podcast. I produce that and co-host it with Jubilee One Earth Economics. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we excel anything at Simple Living Works. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. Send us your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-news. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on our show. This podcast is covered by Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Share Alike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives, is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive lifestyle. It's not a list of rules nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everyone's need, not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, live simply that others may simply live, as our closing theme song proclaims. It's a balance of personal responsibility and advocacy for just public policy. It's more than just personal happiness, though that's quite important. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the 5 life standards of Living More with Less, the classic by Doris Jans and Longacre, and I've discussed these standards in earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The 3 parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video. Links are listed in the show notes. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works Podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. Simply live, learn to live simply so others can live.